From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, vampires. We talk with horror movie expert David Skahl about the making of the 1931 film Dracula, starring Bela Lugosi, and the vampire films it inspired. Also, crime novelist Elmore Leonard. He's been called the greatest living writer of crime fiction by the New York Times. His novel Get Shorty has been made into a movie starring John Travolta and Gene Hackman. It's about a loan shark who goes to Hollywood to collect a debt and decides to stay and produce movies. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Members of the president's national security team are gathering at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, in time for tomorrow's negotiations on Bosnia. Before they left, they met with President Clinton, who described tomorrow's talks as the best chance for peace since the war began 4 years ago. He said, "We have come to a defining moment in Bosnia."
In Dayton, our diplomats face a tremendous challenge. There is no guarantee they will succeed. America can help the parties negotiate a settlement, but we cannot impose a peace.
The president also said if there is an agreement, the U.S. must be involved in the enforcement of the peace as part of NATO forces. He said NATO is the only organization with the strength and track record to enforce peace, and the U.S. is the leader of NATO. The president's national security advisor, Anthony Lake, said today he's very confident that in the end, the Congress will support such a mission. The premier of Quebec says the fight for independence from Canada will continue. A referendum calling for sovereignty for the province was narrowly defeated yesterday. Canadian Prime Minister Jean Chrétien, who's campaigned against secession by Quebec, is calling for reconciliation. From Montreal, the BBC's John Lyne reports.
For most people in Canada, there's a sense of enormous relief that the immediate threat to the unity of the country has been removed. But the closeness of the vote means that much remains unresolved. In the end, the referendum was decided by just 50,000 votes. Quebec has emerged a divided and polarized society. In an address to the nation after the result became clear, the Canadian Prime Minister Jean Chrétien appealed for reconciliation.
Les divisions ne sont jamais faciles.
Division is never easy, and division is never painless. But we can emerge all the stronger for them.
However, Mr. Chrétien studiously avoided making any detailed offer to the people of Quebec.
John Lyne reporting. A new survey finds a majority of Americans are more concerned about potential invasions of privacy by government agencies than by business. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The survey was sponsored by Equifax, the nation's largest credit reporting agency. The survey found that 51% of respondents were more concerned about potential intrusion by government compared with the 43% who were more worried about business intrusions. While the majority of those surveyed believe business does a better job than government of keeping personal information confidential, 82% are somewhat concerned or very concerned about threats to their privacy. Most of those questioned said they believe privacy protection in the year 2000 will remain at least as strong as it is currently or will improve. The survey was based on more than 1,000 telephone interviews conducted nationwide from July 5th to July 17th. The margin of error is plus or minus 3%. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 14.09 points at 4770.66. This is NPR News. President Clinton will meet tomorrow with congressional leaders in an effort to reach agreement on how to keep the government from defaulting on its debts. Republicans are refusing to raise the debt limit ceiling, which would allow the government to keep borrowing to stay in business and to pay its interest payments until the president goes along with their budget plans, which include lower taxes, more modest Medicare and Medicaid programs, and a balanced budget within 7 years. A bomb exploded in Ankara today in an office belonging to the Iraqi National Congress. The group said in a statement that at least 22 people were killed, including the group's chief of security. A military-appointed court in Nigeria today sentenced an environmental activist and three others to death for murder. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
The case centered on the murder of four prominent people in Nigeria's turbulent, oil-producing southeast region, Ogoniland. Ken Sarawiwa and about 30 other activists were accused of the crime last May, all denied the charge. After his sentencing, Sarawiwa declared, "I was found guilty even before I was tried," and said he had been brutalized during the trial. All three judges in the court were appointed by General Sani Abacha's military government. There is no right to appeal. Sarawiwa has drawn world attention with his efforts to stop pollution from oil drilling in Ogoni land. He's also sought autonomy and a share in oil profits for the Ogoni people. The decision is sure to heighten international focus on the heavy-handed rule of Nigeria's leaders and could step up pressure for sanctions against the OPEC member country. I'm Jennifer Ludden reporting.
Boris Yeltsin remains in a Moscow hospital with his second bout of heart trouble in 4 months. His wife says he's feeling better and wants to go home. His doctor says he ought to stay another month. Yeltsin suffers from a condition that restricts the flow of blood to the heart. Mrs. Yeltsin blamed his most recent problem with his most recent trip to the U.S. I'm Nora Rahm, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I don't wear costumes on Halloween, but I don't mind watching a good horror film.
I am Dracula. I bid you welcome. Listen to them. Children of the night. What music they make.
Bela Lugosi's Dracula set off a horror movie craze in America. Our fascination with the vampire continues. Right now, Eddie Murphy is at your local Cineplex playing a vampire from Brooklyn. My guest David Skahl is an expert on horror films with an emphasis on vampire movies. His books include Hollywood Gothic and The Monster Show. His new book, Dark Carnival, is a biography of Todd Browning, who directed the Lugosi version of Dracula in 1931 and the movie Freaks. I asked David Skahl why he thinks we're so captivated by the idea of vampires.
Well, there hasn't been a human civilization in recorded history that has not had some variation on the theme of the vampire. And our reasons for reviving the vampire theme over and over again in literature and popular culture over the centuries there are many different reasons, I think. In our current age, I think it is rather obvious that this huge vampire renaissance in the last 10 years has had everything to do with the parallel AIDS epidemic and our cultural fixation on frightening themes having to do with blood and blood contact. And I think Anne Rice, of course, whose novels are very much one of the driving engines of this vampire revival, is aware of this consciously. And she's played with the metaphor of the vampire as disease. She started writing her vampire chronicles following the death of her young daughter from a blood disease, leukemia. But I think she's also spoken very eloquently about the metaphor she sees connected to the AIDS epidemic, the idea of the vampire as a kind of a symbol for an alternate, supernaturalized kind of sexuality.
Let's look at Dracula, the 1931 Bela Lugosi version, the first American vampire film. Whose idea was it to make the film?
Well, all the studios in Hollywood were interested in the idea of doing Dracula as a film, but in the American film tradition, there were terrifying characters and creatures in the 1920s, but there were no supernatural monsters. If there was a haunting or a horrible character, it would always have to be explained away as the result of a human agency, you know, usually criminal, somebody trying to steal an inheritance or embezzle a fortune. And this is very unlike the European tradition, where the irrational and the fantastic were really part of the European filmmaking tradition from the very beginning, especially in Germany, where we had the prototype horror films like The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and Nosferatu. But in America, it was just assumed that the public would not accept these bizarre stories. So even though Dracula as a stage play was making a lot of money, the studios took a long time deciding to whether or not it was worth the gamble. And it was considered a gamble.
Now, how did Bela Lugosi get the part? He had been in the stage version, yes, of Dracula?
Yes. Bela Lugosi came to America as a political expatriate from Hungary in the early 1920s, and where he was very active in the stage, was a member of the National Theater in Budapest, but got on the wrong side of the revolution. So he ended up here in New York playing all kinds of roles, most of them exotic heavies and foreigners. He learned his roles phonetically because he really never mastered English the way he should, one syllable at a time, which, you know, accounts for that amazing and deliberate manner of speaking that we forever associate with Dracula. But he first played Dracula in 1927 on the Broadway stage.
Bela Lugosi gave a performance that has left an indelible mark on the American imagination. What do you think works so well about his performance of Dracula?
Lugosi's performance kind of sums up the entire history of vampire impersonations in the theater and on film. Stoker's Dracula was nothing like the character Lugosi plays, except that he was certainly evil, but he was a horrible old man who got younger as he drank blood. He never really became attractive and was really a largely offstage presence throughout the book. When they did Dracula on the stage, they had to clean up the character because to follow the conventions of a drawing room mystery melodrama, which is how it had to be produced, Dracula had to be rethought as the kind of character you'd plausibly invite into a drawing room. And that's where we got the evening clothes and the slick back hair and the unctuous Transylvanian charm. But with Lugosi, we see both the charmer, the Valentino-like lover from beyond the grave, but also that hint of pure evil. There's nothing sympathetic about Lugosi. He can charm, but just look at those eyes.
The studio that produced Dracula was concerned about homoerotic overtones in the story. What kind of communication did they have with the writer and director about that?
There were some very interesting annotations on Carl Laemmle Jr.'s script. Carl Laemmle Jr. was the producer of Dracula, the son of Carl Laemmle Sr., who inherited the reins of the studio at the age of 21 as a birthday present. And he was very concerned that Dracula was attacking not only women, but some of the sailors on the ship that took him to England, and of course Renfield, the solicitor who comes to his castle. And he wrote frantically in the margins, you know, Dracula should only go for women and not men. But Browning seemed to ignore this bit of advice, so we do have an aspect of a homoerotic seduction in that scene where Dracula invites Renfield up to his quarters in his castle. And the sexual undercurrents of Dracula have been the subject of a lot of very interesting criticism, mostly in the last 20 years or so, and especially the homoerotic aspects.
My guest is David Scully, has a new biography of Todd Browning. He's the author of Hollywood Gothic, about vampire films, and also the author of The Monster Show, A Cultural History of Horror. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with David Scull, who's written a lot about horror films, monster films, and vampires in general. Now, the director of Dracula, Todd Browning, is the subject of your new biography, Dark Carnival. He has a little vocal cameo in Dracula, where he's the harbor master who goes aboard the ship that had brought Dracula to his castle. And looking in the shadows, we see the crazy Renfield, who has this unearthly laugh. Well, you got it perfect.
Well, I've seen the movie more times than I have to, than I really should admit. But
you got it perfect. But as perfect as it is, I'm going to play the clip from the film so we get to hear the laugh and also the voice of the director, Todd Browning.
They must have come through a terrible storm. What's that? Why, come from that hatchway. Why, he's mad. Look at his eyes. Why, the man's gone crazy.
That's the voice of Todd Browning from his film Dracula. A really interesting sidebar of Dracula is that after that movie was made, there was a Spanish language version of the same movie. Why did they do it? How did they do it?
In the days of the early talkies, half of Hollywood's revenues were coming from the foreign market. And the appeal and novelty of these films was the chance to see actors speaking in their natural voices. So there was great resistance initially to the idea of dubbing films. So for a period of several years, when Hollywood was the only place in the world making sound pictures, simultaneous foreign language renditions were done of the films, not just the soundtracks, but the entire films. They'd be done with different casts, different directors, different photographers. And the Spanish language version of Dracula that was made at night on the same sets as the Browning film was one of the most ambitious. They had an actor, a Spanish actor named Carlos Villarías, play Dracula. He was the only actor who was allowed to watch the rushes because they wanted him to imitate Lugosi as closely as possible.
Wait, so was he supposed to give a Spanish version of an Eastern European accent?
That's an interesting point. One of the reasons these films didn't last all that much longer is that Spanish-speaking audiences around the world were annoyed that Hollywood would just throw together every kind of Spanish accent into one picture. So you'd have actors from Argentina, from Mexico, from Spain, with the clash of all the different accents. To my ear, he sounds pretty Castilian. Whether he was trying to sound like Lugosi is another matter. He did wear the same hairpiece as Lugosi in the film, the identical number. So it really never got a rest. It came off Lugosi's head at dusk and went on Carlos's head until dawn.
Did Dracula start a horror craze in the movies?
Oh, yes. It was a surprise to Universal. They didn't know what to expect. And it ended up saving the studio from bankruptcy. Universal was tottering on the edge of insolvency, as were many of the studios. I mean, this is still in the wake of the stock market crash, of course, in 1930 when the film was filmed. But immediately they rushed into production Frankenstein. Lugosi turned down the part of the monster, something he regretted for the rest of his career, because, of course, he made Boris Karloff a star.
Did Boris Karloff want the part? He was typed as Mummies and Monsters for years afterwards. Or he was doing something in the laboratory.
Yes. Unlike Lugosi, Karloff had a much more prosperous career playing monsters. I mean, he was struggling. He appeared in something like 80 films before he made Frankenstein as a bit player and doing character parts. Played a lot of gangsters and things like that. And Frankenstein put him on the map. And He really had no professional difficulties for the rest of his life. He made a lot of money. He managed his career very wisely, and was always expressed gratitude, you know, to the monster. Never complained about being typecasting. Oh, he didn't like the word horror movie. He liked to call them terror films. Lugosi, on the other hand, with Dracula, which was his first big break in Hollywood, it was also his the beginning of the end of his career. Because audiences never really accepted him in other... Perhaps if he had worn some transforming makeup or something in Dracula, he would have had more versatility. But Dracula's face was Lugosi's. The voice of Dracula was Lugosi's. And he really couldn't escape it. In fact, he was buried in makeup and costume as Dracula when he died in 1956. I think it's the only time in theatrical history I know of that a character actor was so identified with a part that he went to the grave in costume.
Did he ask to be buried that way?
I
hope he wanted it. It would be pretty miserable if he didn't want that.
Apparently, he did mention it was not in his will, as was reported in the newspapers. But apparently, he did mention the wish to friends, and the family decided to do this. It's very, very poignant. Very poignant act.
David Skahl is the author of The Monster Show, Hollywood Gothic, and a new biography of Todd Browning called Dark Carnival. This is Fresh Air. Today is part of Public Radio's National Fundraising Week, so here's my trick-or-treat proposition. Make a pledge, and we'll all be confident of the radio future. If not, the trick is this. You might not find Fresh Air on your station anymore. You see, each station that carries Fresh Air has to pay a fee, and that fee goes toward our production budget. Without your pledge, the station won't be able to carry Fresh Air. I'm counting on your support. Thank you very much. Many public radio stations are fundraising this week and are using this time for a pledge break. For those of you hearing our show uninterrupted, we continue with our special series from our rock historian Ed Ward on the American cities that gave us rock and roll. Today we feature New Orleans. New Orleans was more than the cradle of jazz. It was a city that considered musical education essential, particularly for its black citizens. Decades after Louis Armstrong, several generations of musicians gave us an idiosyncratic and distinctive version of rock and roll. This time I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm gonna need to parachute when I get.
Post-war popular music in New Orleans started the night Lou Chud, a successful producer of records for the Mexican-American market, walked into the Bronze Peacock Club in Houston, Texas, and saw Dave Bartholomew and his band on stage. Chud had been thinking of getting into the rhythm and blues game and found Bartholomew quite knowledgeable about the New Orleans scene, so he put him on retainer, and the hit started coming out of Cosimo Matassa's New Orleans studio. His first big discovery was Antoine Fats Domino, an amiable piano player who remained Chud's meal ticket for over a decade. Chud may have been a hard guy to work for. Bartholomew quarreled with him from time to time, and during one of their estrangements, he agreed to produce a session for Art Roop, who owned L.A.'s specialty label.
Oh, now, Lordy, 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 Miss Claudia, girl, you sure look good to me. Well, please don't excite me, baby. No, it can't be me. Because I guess.
He even used Fats Domino on piano for Lloyd Price's Laudy Miss Claudy, which tore up the charts in 1952. But Roop needed his own man there, and soon found Richard Bumps Blackwell. Blackwell, in turn, found him another piano player. Little Richard, for all his weirdness, turned out to be just what Roop needed, and soon Blackwell was minting gold with him. Just as important as the front men on these recordings were the backup guys. The first generation of New Orleans studio musicians included people like drummer Earl Palmer, whose no-nonsense beat more or less defined black rock and roll, and saxophonist Lee Allen, who wrote the rules for those short solos every rock and roll record had to have. But New Orleans has never treated its black talent with much respect, and at one point a fracas within the musicians' union saw virtually the entire studio crew pick up and leave for Los Angeles. This wasn't as big a tragedy as it might have seemed, though. It just gave the next generation of players a chance. Chief among them was yet another piano player, Alan Toussaint, who assembled a band that recorded with people like Irma Thomas for Lou Chud and, most famously, with Lee Dorsey.
Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti. My uncle there was a passing me. She got a whole lot of rhythm when she walked, and I can hear music when she talked. Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti. Forget about the do and think about me.
There was also a young white guitar player named Mac Rebinac, who was helping out wherever he could find a gig and coming up with the odd rockabilly track.
Standing on the front porch, I grabbed her and kissed her. Why was I surprised when I saw her little sister? Lights out. Lights out. I'm glad now that the lights are out. Sister knows more about what to do when the lights go out.
But New Orleans has really always been about black music, and Rebinac, who was defined solo fame as Dr. John, spent most of his time working with rhythm and blues stars. Along with Rebinac, there was a family of musicians in New Orleans who divided their time between being studio musicians and recording under a bunch of different names. Sometimes they were the Hawks, sometimes they were Art Neville and his band, and much later, towards the end of the 60s, they were the Meters. To their mother, of course, they were just the Neville brothers, whose inimitable grooves helped pave the way for funk. There were many other important musicians in New Orleans during the early 60s, but by the decade's end, the only ones making real impact on the national charts were Lee Dorsey and the Meters. Many of the rest had left town or retired, disgusted with the city's disregard for their talents. A step to change this began in the 70s with the first New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, but the vibrant scene was long gone. Today, New Orleans music is a relic, and the light has gone out. Fortunately, it's still widely available in recorded form.
Ed Ward is a writer living in Berlin. Tomorrow, we move to Memphis. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Get Shorty. We talk with crime novelist Elmore Leonard. His best-selling novel is the basis of the new film starring John Travolta as a loan shark who uses his financial know-how and intimidation techniques to become a Hollywood producer. We'll ask Elmore Leonard how he knows so much about small-time criminals and Hollywood.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Rhino Records, presenting Blues Fest, Modern Blues of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, a collection of contemporary blues artists including B.B. King, Robert Cray, and Stevie Ray Vaughan. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, Get Shorty, is based on a best-selling novel by my guest Elmore Leonard. He's one of America's most popular and most critically acclaimed crime writers. His novels include 52 Pickup, Freaky Deaky, Kill Shot, Rum Punch, and his latest, Riding the Rap. Pulp Fiction director Quentin Tarantino cites Leonard as a major influence. Tarantino has bought the movie rights to four of Leonard's novels, and he convinced a reluctant John Travolta to star in Get Shorty. Travolta plays a loan shark from the East Coast who goes to L.A. to collect on a gambling debt and finds that a loan shark can feel quite at home in Hollywood. The guy who owes him money, Harry Zim, is a producer of schlock horror films. Travolta figures he could be a good producer. After all, he knows a lot about money and intimidation. Travolta gets his hands on a script he wants to produce, and he's looking for some help from the star of Zim's schlock horror films, played by Rene Russo.
I brought you a copy of the script.
Oh, I already read it. Harry left a copy at the house.
Well, how'd you like it?
Well, it's not horrible.
Well, I don't like the title, and I don't like some of the characters in it.
So you read it?
Well, I haven't read it yet, but I will.
You and Harry make a great team.
Is that right?
Listen, I'm going to make a deal with him.
Oh, good. You found out a character you like for yourself?
No, I don't want to act in it. I want to produce it, especially if I help him get Martin.
Well, hey, that's fair, huh?
Yeah. So what do you get out of it?
Is that why you came down here to ask me that?
I want to know.
Well, why would anyone want to be in the movies?
Yesterday, you were a loan shark.
Yeah, but I was never that into it. And especially this book about having respect. Forget about it. I mean, it's bad enough treating these guys like they're your heroes, you know, smiling at stupid comments they think are so funny.
You think the movie business is any different?
Elmore Leonard, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
You write mostly in dialogue.
Yeah.
There's not that much, you know, like a lot of crime fiction, there's a lot of interior thought, a lot of like first person, just like thinking, contemplating.
Mm-hmm.
Very little of that in your novels. It's mostly dialogue. Why have you taken that direction in your writing?
I like dialogue. I've always liked dialogue from the very beginning. When I started 44 years ago, I was influenced by writers who were very strong in dialogue. Hemingway, John O'Hara, Steinbeck. A writer not many people know about, Richard Bissell, in the 50s. Pajama Game was made from one of his books, 7.5 Cents. I like dialogue. I like to see that white space on the page, in the exchanges of dialogue, rather than those big, heavy paragraphs full of words. Because I remember being feeling intimidated back in the, say, in the 40s when I first started to read popular novels. Book of the Month Club books, I would think, God, there are too many words in this book. And I still think there are too many words in most books. But dialogue appeals to me. If I can set a scene, and this is what I do, I write in scenes, and I always write from a character's point of view so that the scene takes on the character's sound, at least to some extent. The sound even goes into the narrative.
When you started writing crime fiction, were there places that you would hang out just to listen?
I would hang out in Detroit, Frank Murphy Hall of Justice, which is the criminal court, and watch examinations, little trials, rather than the, these are the pretrial exams to find out whether a crime has been committed or not. And then finally, by 1979-80, I was spending time with the Detroit police. And I did a piece for the Detroit News on homicide section. That was the first and only piece of journalism I've ever done. And it was the kind of piece that maybe you'd spend 3 days with the homicide cops and then take a day to write it, and that was it. But I was with them at least 3 weeks before I even wrote a word, and got to know them, and they trusted me, and they showed me their case files. I could just sit there in the squad room and listen to them.
What would you say struck you as being most different about the way cops talked from the way your friends or colleagues talked?
well, the way cops talk, they're they're not as educated for the most part. They'd remind me of professional soldiers, professional non-coms. A guy who's been a sergeant in the Army for 20 years or so. But I respected them. They really wanted to close cases. I saw that nobody was dragging his foot. They were all working hard, and they liked what they were doing. And that inspired me.
Now, it seems to me you're also particularly interested in colloquialisms and, you know, colorful language inventions that people come up with, little slang words.
Yeah, but you have to be very careful about using slang because expressions come into popularity and go out overnight. I remember back in 68, 69, the bounce was an expression. You haven't even heard it, but I wrote a book, The Big Bounce, because the bounce seemed to be, you're looking for the bounce, you're looking for a little excitement. And I used that in a title, and I thought this was going to be a popular expression, and it didn't make it, the bounce. You know, nobody uses it now. There are things that you still hear cool, and I don't know, even some people are still saying out of sight. But you have to be, I can't rely on slang, and I don't. It's rhythms of speech that I'm mostly interested in.
Danny DeVito plays a character in Get Shorty who is a very much in-demand actor. He's got a memoir that shows up in everybody's house or in everybody's bathroom. Everybody's reading it. And he's an actor who's very short but has a very big ego.
Uh-huh.
I wonder if you've met a lot of actors in Hollywood with very big egos who you've had to deal with. Maybe you could tell us a story without mentioning names about working with actors.
Well, Dustin Hoffman says that the book's about him. He told Rene Russo when they were doing Outbreak. Is it Break? Outbreak.
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 Breakout would be about pimples.
Yeah.
This is about an epidemic.
Yeah. And I don't know how he did that movie in that suit, in that...
Oh, right, that space suit that you wear to protect yourself from the germs, yeah.
Yeah, the whole movie. He asked her what she was doing next, and she said, Get Shorty. And he said, oh, he said, you know, that book's about me. And he even told me that one time on the phone. He said, my people kept that book away from me because they told me it's about me.
Why does he think it's about him, and
because,
is it?
Because we had spent some months together over a period of 7 or 8 months. We had meetings about a book of mine, La Brava, that he was interested in, but came to naught. He made a deal with a studio and then decided not to do it. But I asked him, I said, do you recognize yourself in it? Do you see anything that... Any lines, for example, that I might have picked up from those meetings? And he said, well, no. I said, no, well, no. There are a lot of short actors in Hollywood and a lot of short stars, you know? And somewhere along the line, when I was writing the book, I thought Get Shorty was a good title. And then I thought that Chili Palmer, the character, would refer to, once they got on the track of Martin Weir, the actor, that he would refer to him as Shorty. I thought he would in the book, but he didn't. It just didn't feel right. When I would get to that part where he might refer to him that way, he didn't. And so I had the title, but no Shorty, no one referred to as Shorty. Because when Nora Ephron reviewed it in the New York Times, she didn't know who Shorty was. She called the New York Times and asked them, and then they called my publisher and say, who's Shorty? And then my publisher called me and said, they want to know who Shorty is. I said, well, at least read one of the last lines in the book in a scene where Chili Palmer, referring then to the actor, says, he's too short. And the woman, Karen, his girlfriend now, who in the book was then a studio executive, says, they're all short. You shoot up. And that was it. That was the only reference.
So is that character related to Dustin Hoffman at all?
No. No, not any more so than any other. He might have ordered off the menu when I was with him once or twice, where I got the idea of actors not ordering from the menu.
Right, they have to make up something very difficult and very special that's designed, you know, a kind of customized lunch.
But he didn't do that. Mm-hmm. He didn't go through that elaborate description of the omelet that he wanted. But everyone confirms, not everyone, but people do confirm this, that, actors don't order from the menu.
So do you like working in Hollywood, or do you find things often go wrong?
Well, it's work. And I don't think of book writing as work. That's the main difference. I'm writing a book, and I'm getting complete satisfaction. Well, when it goes right, but by the end of the day, I'm happy with what I've done because I put in a full day, 9:30 to 6 o'clock, and the time flies by. And it's the best job in the world. Journalists say to me, "He says, God, you got the best job in the world. You sit here, you write exactly what you want. The time." Flies by. The only person I have to please is myself. Well, eventually, of course, I have to please my editor. But if your editor, your publisher likes you, knows that it can, and they can count on you, they know that you're going to deliver, then you're all set. But then you go out to Hollywood, and now you have all sorts of people to please. And wives and girlfriends too, and there's just a lot more work. There's all that rewriting, and when you're adapting your own book, your enthusiasm, your energy has already gone into the book. Now you've got to get it back up again to write the screenplay, and there'll be some new scenes that, in which you can exercise then an amount of energy, to get excited about it. But for the most part, what are you doing? You're just kind of redoing it. So I'm not even sure if I'm any good as a screenwriter.
Elmore Leonard is my guest, and his novel Get Shorty is the basis of the new film Get Shorty, starring John Travolta. His new novel is called Riding the Rap. Let's take a short break, and we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Elmore Leonard. His novel Get Shorty is the basis of the new film Get Shorty, and his latest novel is called Riding the Rap. Now, in Get Shorty, in the novel and in the movie, the character of Chili, the character played in the movie by Travolta, is always saying to people who he wants to intimidate, "Look at me."
Uh-huh.
And because the character is so confident, and because he has the power to back up his confidence, people usually get the point when they look at him. I mean, he does intimidate them.
Mm-hmm.
Then another character tries that, and it doesn't work because he doesn't have the confidence or the power to back it up.
Mm-hmm.
How did you think of coming up with that? Was there an idea behind that?
The real Chili Palmer, who worked for this friend of mine who was the private eye, once in a while were retained by the Golden Nugget in Las Vegas to call on individuals in South Florida who owe them money. Not to intimidate them, just to ask them, are you going to start making payments? Be nice. There wasn't any, no violence ever involved. But my friend, the private investigator, Bill Marshall, he would talk to the guy, and he's a very, Marshall is a very entertaining guy, and he would get the guy laughing. But Chili Palmer, who was sitting next to him, and he would stare at the guy and just stare and never say a word. Now, he never said, look at me. That I made that up. But the idea of the intimidation in that stare, I thought I could use that.
Yeah, well, his motto, Chili's motto, is actually don't talk when you don't have to.
Yeah. Yeah, he said, yeah, there's a line where he says, I'm not going to say a word to him. I'm not going to say any more than I have to, if that. And Barry keeps waiting for a laugh on that line.
And in the novel, when he's trying to intimidate somebody, he says, you know, I mean, his approach is don't tell them what can happen if they don't pay.
Yeah.
Just stare at them, because anything you tell them isn't going to be as bad as what they can imagine. They're going to imagine anything far worse than what you could do. So just let their imagination work.
Yeah. And Harry Zim says to him, Gene Hackman, he's, what do you, break their legs then, huh? And Chili says, what do you mean, break their legs? How are they going to pay you if they're in the hospital with their legs broken? No, we don't break their legs.
So what did you learn about how loan sharking works from the real Chili Palmer?
Well, he actually, we really didn't get that much into it. It was just the idea that he's a loan shark. But I never got into the day-to-day, what he goes through in the business, how he loans the money. Oh, there's a little monologue in the book on how he tries to dissuade someone from borrowing the money. Don't borrow this money unless you know you're going to pay it back. You're not going to sign any kind of an agreement. You're not putting up your house, but you're going to pay me this money with so much interest, and that's it, and it's your word. But please don't take it unless you know you're going to pay me, you know? And it's quite a nice monologue, I thought, in the book. And a lot of it is from Chili, the real Chili.
Now, in your latest novel, Writing the Rap, there's a kind of unusual twist on the hostage story or the kidnapping story.
Yeah.
Would you say something about the hustle you came up with for that?
The individual who masterminds this, if that's the word, he had watched what had been going on in Beirut with the hostages, how they were kept, especially how they were blindfolded and chained or tied up, what they were fed, and he wonders, is there any money in that? Is there any money in hostage taking? And to do it right. He thinks, yeah, well, look, if you get a guy who's got a lot of money and you blindfold him and he doesn't know where he is and you don't even talk to him for a few days or a week or so, and then finally you say, do you want to get out of this? You tell me how you can give me $2 million. You have to work it out. No ransom notes. Nobody knows this but you. You tell us how you can deliver to us a certain amount of money, a couple of million, and we'll let you go. If we don't like the idea, you're dead. So then it's up to the victim, you see? And it sounds good. Of course, in this book, the perpetrator wants to be very, very realistic about it. He wants straw mats. He wants to feed them mutton, stale cheese. He wants to do it. He wants to do it exactly the way they did in Beirut. He said, well, we'll put him in a basement somewhere. And his accomplice says, where are you going to find a basement in Florida? Now, it just everything is against him doing it the way he feels is the right way.
Elmore Leonard, his novel Get Shorty is the basis of the new film. His latest novel is Riding the Rap. This is Fresh Air. After hearing about the loan shark and Get Shorty, I'm in the position of asking you for money. While no threat implied here about breaking your legs, etc., no intimidation techniques, just the simple truth, which is pretty darn compelling. Each station that carries Fresh Air has to pay a fee, which helps to cover the cost of producing the show. Let's face it, your station is only going to pay for the show if the listeners support it. So if you hope to keep listening to Fresh Air, this is your chance to make sure it's there for you. Thank you very much for your support. We're back with crime novelist Elmore Leonard. The new film Get Shorty is based on his best-selling novel. Do you think you would have made a good criminal? Let's face it, in a lot of ways you have the mind. You know, you say most of your stuff isn't from research. You just, you know, sit at your typewriter and think it up.
Well, I can think of that, but I wouldn't have the nerve.
Mm-hmm. Are you a confident guy? I mean, you know,
I'm confident about my work. But right. my work. Yeah, right. But that took about 15 years, you know, to gain confidence in what you do. I couldn't imagine walking into a bank and saying, give me what money you have on top of that little alarm system that the last bill is lying on, and don't give me any dye pack, and don't give me any funny money or monies with the serial numbers, you know, listed. If you know enough about it, I think you can get away with it. I think bank robbery would be pretty easily, even though 9 out of 10 bank robbers are caught. And I think mostly because they tell other people what they do, and because they're not really professional about it. They need money for drugs.
Now, a lot of your guys are talkers, and they could talk their way.
They have to be talkers.
Yeah, right. They talk their way into things and out of things. And can you do that?
No.
So you couldn't do in real life what your characters do, verbally?
Oh, no, never. No. See, the beauty of it in a scene where you end the scene with a line, with the perfect line, you know? But you write in the book, and you have months to think about it.
Right. Now, do you, like, 5 minutes or 2 days after the moment has passed, think of a good last line you could have said in real life, or do you not think in real life in those terms?
Well, in real life, I'm sitting on a bench at Aspen, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, dead tired. I've come down the mountain. A woman skis down, 25, 30 years younger than I am, puts one boot up on the bench and says, I don't know what's more satisfying, taking off my boots or... And then she used an expression for sleeping with somebody.
And you said...
And I said, huh, like that. And that was probably 15 years ago. And I've been trying to think of it doesn't even have to be snappy, just something, a decent comeback, you know.
What would you have wanted to communicate to her?
Just something clever. What would Woody Allen say? That would have been enough for me, yeah. I hadn't thought of that before either. I should have put myself in Woody Allen's. And he would have said something a little out, you know.
Well, there might have been a difference between what he said in real life or what he said in a movie.
Well, that's true. I don't think, it wasn't an invitation. She was simply describing how she felt.
Now, I know you were a drinker for many years. When you stopped drinking, mm-hmm. did drinking change in your novels?
Yeah. No, the drinking didn't change. I had a little bit more energy then for writing, and I think my books got better. I quit in, when did I quit? 77. It's been 18 years. And I think from the late 70s into the 80s on that my books have gotten a lot better.
Did your characters drink any more or less when you stopped?
No, they continued to drink. I couldn't stop them. They were still drinking Early Times and Jack Daniels. No.
What is it still like for you to write alcohol scenes when
no problem
you can't drink?
No.
Do you particularly enjoy it or anything?
Yeah, because they enjoy it. They enjoy it. I have in the book I'm writing. Karen Sisko, the marshal, and her dad, who's my age, are sitting in the backyard drinking Jack Daniels, sipping it and talking. And, they really enjoy it. And I can understand that. But I don't have any desire to drink, thank God, because I know if I did, I would, I'd get drunk again. I'd become a drunk.
You started your fiction career writing Westerns.
Yeah.
Tell us about one of the Western heroes you created.
Western heroes. Did I create any?
Western characters.
Oh, yeah. Hombre. I like that character a lot, which Paul Newman played.
In the movie?
In a movie, yeah. Yeah, I thought I was very proud of that one. And also I liked Valdez's Coming, which Burt Lancaster did. Valdez's Coming is my favorite Western that I wrote. And at the time, when I read it now, I can see my style beginning to change into what I'm doing now. Really not what I'm doing now, but it began to change.
More dialogue-oriented?
Yeah, a little more dialogue, a little more characters, a little more human. I'm loosening up a little bit. And that's what I finally learned, because I had studied Hemingway so closely and learned a lot, but I didn't agree with his attitude about life, about himself. He took everything himself, everything so seriously. But your style comes out of your attitude, what kind of a person you are, you know, your personality, how you see things. Are you optimistic? Are you funny? Are you grim? What? This is all out of your attitude. And once I learned that, then I had to find other writers to study and imitate.
Well, how would you compare your attitude to Hemingway's?
Well, I don't see that much. There is that much to take seriously in everyday situations that come up that people worry about, or people worry about things that might happen, you know, which is a big waste of time. I don't worry.
You don't worry?
I don't worry.
So this is one of the differences between you and Hemingway. You don't worry about things.
No.
Don't brood about things.
We know how seriously he took himself, right, with that shotgun he put in his mouth.
Right.
No, I don't see any reason to do that.
Right.
I don't take my work that seriously, and I think that's what keeps me loose. If I try to write, if I catch myself trying to write, I'll fall right on my face. I'll see it. If I see in the prose that I'm boy, look at me writing, I rewrite it because I think it's distracting.
Well, Elmore Leonard, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Terry, thank you.
Elmore Leonard, the new film Get Shorty is based on his novel of the same name. His latest novel is Riding the Rap. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Rena Bander. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.